Nation's Restaurant News Podcast. I'm your host, Holly Petrie, here with the latest episode, and I'm joined by my lovely coworkers. I will introduce them, starting to my left.
I'm Lisa Jennings, executive editor of Nation's Restaurant News.
I'm Sam Okus, editor-in-chief of Nation's Restaurant News, and this is not you introducing us, this is us introducing ourselves.
Well, I wanted everybody to know the direction we were going in because we hadn't pre-discussed it, so I was just trying to ease it around the
horn. There's order. I appreciate
that. Let's keep this all in the room.
I'm Leanne Sitzmeister, managing editor of NRN.
I'm food and beverage editor Brett Thorne.
I'm Joanna Fantozzi, senior editor with Nation's Restaurant News.
We all did it.
Woohoo!
That's a wrap, folks.
And do you know what Holly just did? Holly, would you care to share with our audience?
I just got a tattoo at the NRA show.
Woohoo!
Where did you get it, by the way?
I got it at Lunchbox, and it's on my ankle.
Where did you get it?
I mean,
the one place at the NRA show giving free tattoos.
No, I thought it would be about the other tattoo parlor.
So Lunchbox is giving away free tattoos at the NRA show, and I figured, if you're only going to do this once in your life, why not? It's an opportunity, so I just went ahead and did it.
They've given 50 of them. I heard somebody say at the booth that they've done 50 of them. That blows my mind.
Is that total or is that today? Because the one guy said he gave 24 today.
Maybe that was just today that they did 50 that year.
Yeah.
That's insane. I mean, kudos to all those people. And kudos to Lunchbox. That's a creative idea.
What was the pain level like? I'm just curious.
It was not painful.
Holly's a professional at getting tattoos, so.
This is old hat.
I feel like if I was tattooed, I would have a different opinion.
I did not
think about
it. One time I had dinner at the James Beard House. Actually, hundreds of times I had dinner at the James Beard House. But one time there was a chef who had just got a huge dragon tattoo, and it hadn't fully healed, so it looked like he had sort of this writhing dragon on his arm, and it hurt, and he realized that he should have, you know, reconsidered the timing for his tattoo.
The chef with the dragon tattoo.
Exactly. It had the potential to be pretty, but it was swollen at that point.
You were not inspired to go get your own dragon tattoo?
No, I'm not interested in getting tattoos at this point in time.
Yeah, I hear that.
Well, maybe, who knows? I don't know what the future may bring, but no, it's not on my agenda.
How should we recap our day? What did you guys do yesterday? I wasn't here yesterday.
You were not here.
Nor did you listen to
the podcast. We already talked about it yesterday.
Yes, I'm an avid listener.
It's been up for a beautiful day now.
It was the best podcast ever. It was
well,
so good.
And then I'm just going to go.
Well, and Sam, you're definitely not busy doing anything at the NRA show.
That's right. I'm sitting around doing nothing.
Not
you guys
at all.
Recorded a podcast.
Not at all.
We went around the horn and we talked about our day. So we talked about the trends that we saw, some booths that we enjoyed. We talked about what we were doing in Chicago. So who wants to start? Who wants to kick us off?
Well, why don't we start with Sam? And if he likes, he can also give a brief overview of his day yesterday.
Thank you.
Since he was not here to do
swear
so.
We usually like each
and
other.
And feels left out.
Holly just gets offended when I try to take control of the podcast.
We've been together for 4 days now. It's a lot of days.
Oh, wow. Has it been 4 days? Yeah, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, say Sunday. Wow.
Last decker.
All right, I'll start. So I have primarily been talking to restaurant executives and founders here in our booth. We have a great setup here with cameras. We're doing video, which, of course, we will be sharing at nrn.com. For those of you listening who are at the show, please do swing by and say hello. Maybe you could be on camera too, 3831. But I would say, to recap what everybody's talking about, it feels to me like all of the restaurant operators are, I mean, everything is about resilience, which is interesting because it was like, that was the theme 2 years ago. But right now it's like, everybody's looking at the recession that's coming. They're all still dealing with labor. They're dealing with cost increases, inflation. But what's interesting is, I think, just how resilient everybody is. And, you know, nobody is like, woe is me. Everybody's just like, well, we figured out how to deal with crisis, and we're dealing with every ebb and flow that we have. So that's been the theme of a lot of those conversations. It's just like, you got to get creative. You got to adapt. And, you know, if there's a recession, there's a recession. Honestly, some people have been talking about the recession actually could be, for some parts of the restaurant industry, a good thing, because it will lead to, you know, there might be workers
deflation,
available, unfortunately.
And maybe price deflation.
And trade down from casual dining. So really better for QSR, fast casual. But yeah, it's been the theme of a lot of the conversations. It's been a really good show, though. A lot of people here. It feels busier than most shows I've been to. and seen a lot of faces of people I like and enjoy and have been glad to reconnect with them. So that's my day, two days.
Do you remember what we did last night, Sam?
Most of it.
Well, no, I honestly didn't mean it that way. I'm not exposing your...
That was your segue into Menu Masters.
Yes. Trying to talk about Menu Masters.
Thank you.
Which was an amazing party. Yeah. So good. Yeah. I'm still dazzled by Thomas Keller's speech. Oh my goodness.
Totally. Yeah.
Which I recapped in the story today that all of you can read on NRN.com.
Yeah.
Beautiful speech. It really spoke to restaurateurs as nurturing people and the evolution of what it means to be a chef and how our cuisine has evolved, which it has done tremendously over the past decades, and we forget that.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up, because I've never met Thomas Keller. Didn't know what to expect. It's easy to expect some of these celebrities to be like reserved and difficult, but like he wasn't that at all. He was a really lovely person, and his speech was so heartfelt. And that was awesome. That was kind of a career highlight for me. I think being able to introduce him and Rohini Day, who was our innovator award winner for Menu Masters. She's incredibly inspiring. All of our award winners are great and inspiring, but Rohini Day and Thomas Keller last night, like that was cool to be able to be a part of that.
Both of their speeches were amazing. I especially loved how Rohini Day really spoke about her experience as an advocacy work for women in the restaurant industry. And I think that that's been a theme I've been hearing here and there. I interviewed Andrew Zimmern this morning. So that'll be in a podcast this week, I believe.
This very podcast.
This very podcast. Oh, sorry, I didn't realize that.
Stick around a few more minutes.
Sorry. A little sneak peek of that is that he spoke about women in the industry. And was speaking about how just walking around, even this year, like a lot of the people you see are the same old people in air quotes, and it's a lot of white men, and it's great to see people like Rohini Day who are advocating for more women and people of color in the industry. So you'll hear more about that in a bit.
And to that end, too, I would also put in a plug for Tiffany Derry and her partner Tom Foley came by to do a video today. That video, by the time you're hearing this, should be up on our YouTube page, hopefully, if not soon. Because they have Roots Chicken Shack as a concept that they want to franchise in historically marginalized communities. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Andrew Zimmer, Tiffany Derry, just people who are actively trying to change the status quo of the restaurant industry, make it a place of opportunity for more communities of people.
Yeah. There's still a lot of places, I think, for it to go.
100%.
And speaking of Andrew Zimmer, I today spoke with, for people at the show who know the Next Bite booth is next to the Tyndall booth. Tyndall is a plant-based chicken, and Andrew Zimmern was there today promoting a sandwich that he created with using that product. And it happened to be next to the Next Bite booth, where there's a giant, or a life-size cutout of Tom Colicchio. And if anybody knows the relationship between Andrew Zimmern and Tom Colicchio, should know that they should look on Twitter, because there is some very comical, I believe, film of Andrew Zimmern responding to the cutout of Tom Colicchio there, I'm told, by Jeff Batty, who I spoke to, who's the chief growth officer for Next Bite. And that was actually a really interesting conversation, hopefully a podcast that will come. And he talked a little bit about a new brand that's coming out of Next Bite, a virtual brand that really that uses Dylan LeMay, who is a TikTok star, who is known, used to work at Cold Stone Creamery, and he's known for throwing ice cream, and I mean literally throwing scoops of ice cream. And he was doing this at the Next Bite booth. People were gathering to try to catch in a cup or their mouths a scoop of ice cream thrown by this TikTok star, and it was hilarious.
That sounds
messy.
And
there will be video. Look, I believe tomorrow we'll have coverage.
Nice.
So that's another little tidbit, Andrew Zimmern related.
That's very fun. Oh my god. Jinx.
Throwing ice cream. How does one discover that talent, I wonder?
I don't know. He was good at it. He was very good.
Well, like with his bare hand? Was he flicking it with a spoon?
No, he scoops. He makes a scoop. He forms it a little bit, and then he flings it across, you know, quite a distance. And the trick is, can you catch it? I imagine he catches it quite well, but he was the thrower.
So it's like a highlight or lacrosse, sort of.
Yeah. I guess.
If you say so.
Yeah. We trust you, Brett. A smaller thing to catch it with, I think, is good.
Depending on the scoop, I guess.
Depending on the scoop.
Very interesting. I'm very curious to know how it went with people catching it in their mouths. I imagine it was quite messy at that booth.
Well, it was, actually. I feel bad for whoever has to clean the carpet later, but...
I don't want to be hit in the face with ice cream.
Yeah, I wouldn't either.
Yeah.
I don't want to be hit in the face with anything.
It also feels like it could be a waste of ice cream if it's not gone.
True, that's
messy.
Terrible.
And I hate to waste ice cream.
That's right.
Would you rather get a free tattoo at a trade show or get hit in the face with an ice cream scoop at a trade show?
Is that even a choice? You can wipe off the ice cream.
I know, I'm just thinking that. Like, I would rather do that than get a tattoo, but I have no tattoos.
I would much rather not get hit in the face with ice cream. Oh my god.
As evidenced by the fact that you got the free tattoo at the trade show today.
So I ate ice cream. I had boba ice cream. Boba obviously is super trendy.
Yep.
I had some boba tea, and this particular one was one of those bursting boba where you have a liquid center, and it had cinnamon and poppy, as in poppy seed, and sweetened tea. It was good. But the boba ice cream just had little pieces of boba in the ice cream. That was fun.
That's interesting.
Does it freeze?
It remains soft.
Gets more chewy.
Softened, yes.
That's cool.
And that was cool.
I'm glad, Lisa, that you mentioned the Next Bite partnership with that brand that they're going to be opening. The TikTok guy who froze ice cream. Because I found that's a theme I'm seeing is the, I'm calling it the, and I'm probably going to do some sort of a story, podcast, video, I don't know what, something coming soon on tech merging with operations, I spoke with Pop Menu, and they were talking about they're opening a restaurant, they just opened a restaurant, and they're basically using it to test out their technology, but also at the same time, they're saying, well, now we know what it's like to be on the other side, and we know what the pain points are, and they're like, well, if it does well, maybe we'll open more. It's just kind of like a basic American concept, fried chicken, southern, in Atlanta, and I think it's kind of interesting that we're seeing the lines between tech and operations blur, and that's a theme I'm seeing.
Yeah. I mean, though, there is the challenge of the fact that running restaurants is really hard, and that the food has to taste good, and hey, let's be tech people and open a restaurant. I've eaten food at restaurants designed by tech people, and it's not great. So I hope they actually bring in some culinary people to make the food delicious as well as be delivered seamlessly and magically with the push of a button on a kiosk.
Yeah, they brought in a culinary team.
Well, that's something Rohini Day was talking about last night, is that she, being in the food industry, was like her fourth or fifth career move.
True.
And she's not the person who is doing the cooking at Vermillion. She's not the cook. She right. is the brains of the operation. And so that was what I found really interesting, is that she has a business degree, I believe. That she used to work at World Bank.
Yeah.
She's a fascinating person, but she's not the cook. She's the face of the operation and the brains, but she's not the cook.
Well, and there are tons of restaurant operators who are cooks. They hire cooks.
Yeah.
Well, that's true of Tiffany Derry and Tom Foley as well.
Well, Tiffany's a chef.
No, that's what I mean. But like Tom came in as the business partner, and they call themselves. Tom says he's pens and paper, and Tiffany's pots and pans. And when we talked to Zach Flansman the other day from Brownback, same idea, you know. And so that's an interesting thing that works for a lot of people, which is you've got to bring it in culinary experience, but you also have to bring it in systems and scalability. And sometimes you have that person who can do both of those things, but often you have to find a partnership to make it work.
Right. I ran into our friend James Park today, who is at the show.
He was at a Cubs game today. He must have come in early.
Good for him.
I know, right?
Former Garbanzo CEO, now has his own Korean, mostly chicken wing concept called Wing Walk. And I didn't ask him what he was looking for at the show. It's nice to see him, but he's not a chef at all. He's right. He's marketing and entrepreneuring. Yeah. And nice to see him.
So, Leanne, what were some of the conversations you had today? Because I know you were quite busy.
Yes, I spoke with many a restaurant executive today, many of which I'm sure you'll be hearing on the podcast before too long. A couple of interesting things I heard today. I was speaking with the CMO of Del Taco, who was talking a lot about that brand's current value deals. In this age of inflation, we're hearing less and less about value deals at QSR because it's just not super sustainable for the chains. And so it was interesting to hear how Del Taco is approaching that on their menu. I also spoke with Jack Gibbons of FB Society, formerly Front Burner Restaurants out of Dallas. They have some really interesting approaches to workforce retention and recruitment. He was telling me about how at one of their restaurants, anytime anyone comes in to interview for any job, they serve them a meal. So you at least, and that makes people feel welcome and like, oh, I want to work here. I already feel welcome. I'm greeted with like a plate of food. I think he said tacos. I made a joke about wanting to interview there. Sam,
I oh boy.
I'm leaving you to work in a restaurant in Dallas.
Boy, what does that say about NRN that you would leave to go
just
work
buy me some tacos, Sam. It's not easy.
I flew you out to Chicago to be a part of the show. That's not enough.
just need some tacos.
You had a lot of free food at Menu Masters last
year. I did have a lot of free food at Menu Masters.
Literally, this
more
job is a
food,
lot
think,
of free food.
Food and drinks. They had some other interesting approaches. I'll save some of that for a podcast in the future. I won't give away all the secrets now. Had a lot of really interesting conversations today, and looking forward to more tomorrow, assuming my voice holds out that long. It's starting to crack.
I know, me and you both.
I may need to take over for you guys.
I've actually been getting some emails, speaking of inflation fighting menus, where there are places that are promoting mostly small chains and independent restaurants, like for the budget conscious or budget affected consumer who's paying $1 million for gas and all the food prices are going up.
I'm sure those will be really popular too, since a lot of QSRs really just aren't taking that anymore. From a lot of my brands, I'm seeing that there's just not as much room for LTOs and deals because they keep taking price increases. They're going the other way.
Right, yeah, all
exactly.
of them.
Exactly.
So Lisa, you were out on the floor pretty much all day.
No, I wasn't actually.
I barely saw you the whole entire day.
I did an interview with Ben's Friends, which is a really interesting group, that a community of people who are seeking sobriety, which is
interesting.
Not like AA, it's not a program, but it's meant to be just a network, a community, a place where people can go and find like-minded people in the industry. There's such a culture of being in the restaurant industry, it's hard for people who are in the industry to really relate to a lot of, your 9-to-5 workers, because, the life is so different if you work in a restaurant. So this is a group that's really focused on our industry, and they're here to let people know that they exist, and the group has grown incredibly because of the pandemic, not surprisingly, because people were shut down, lost their jobs, and were sitting in their apartments drinking alone. And so they went on Zoom, they took Ben's Friends on, to Zoom, and now have this national platform that has created a real fire under the whole idea of it. Chapters are growing across the country, and so they're here to really let employers know also that they can be a resource, a tool, not only for workers to find, like-minded people who are going through the same struggles to help each other, but for employers to learn how to talk to those workers and to, instead of, he said, it used to be that somebody showed up to work drunk, they got fired. You wanted them out. And the message now is, you need those people. Let's get them help. And so that was a really interesting conversation, and I wrote about that again today. I did walk the floor quite a bit, but not all day.
Did you go to the Beverage Pavilion?
I didn't go to the Beverage Pavilion. I'm going to go to Lakeside tomorrow, and I still haven't been over to the other side of the hall. But today I had Beyond Meats. They have a new beef product that they were serving as a teriyaki steak that is pretty good. I liked it. And there was a kimchi guy across the alley that put that guy's kimchi on, and it was fabulous.
I am seeing this a lot because yesterday Beyond was doing a taco with that beef,
and the kimchi guy was putting it, and it tasted amazing with the kimchi, and I've been seeing that a lot, and it's just kind of adorable that, like, the nearby, the neighboring booths are, like, helping each other and putting things like, oh, put this on this, like, because I'm, you know, friends with them, and it's the kimchi tasted good on the taco.
It was delicious.
And that's so food service-y, because restaurant people help each other.
Exactly.
But I was asking about the beverage pavilion, because there are a lot of spirit-free beverages, you know, beer and wine without alcohol, that fits into sobriety. And one of the, my two regular bars, two of the bartenders are sober. It's a thing, and it's something that, you know, I think, I've never heard anybody give them grief about the fact that they're selling alcohol to people and not drinking it themselves. I think it's becoming increasingly an accepted thing,
which is
great.
Yeah. I think the culture is changing, which is great to hear.
Well, Joanna, we already heard a little bit of your interview, but why don't you tell us a little bit about your interview with Andrew Zimmern?
What didn't we talk about?
Andrew Zimmern's a fascinating guy. We basically, obviously a world-renowned celebrity chef, we spoke a bit about gender and racial equity within the industry. We spoke a little bit about Tyndall. And we spoke a bit, a lot actually, about environmentally conscious efforts that others are making. The plant-based movement, he said that he's taken out 75% of the meat out of his diet. And that's a thing that a lot of celebrity chefs and restaurateurs are doing now. So it was a really interesting conversation.
Great. Well, thank you all for joining me today. Happy day two of the show. And I will see you all back here tomorrow, booth 3831.
Bye.
Thanks, Holly.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Joanna Fantozzi, Senior Editor with Nation's Restaurant News. We're here with Chef Andrew Zimmern, and we're going to be chatting a bit about his experience at the show and what he's up to these days. So just to start off, Chef, could you tell me a bit about what you've seen the past day or two at the show?
Oh, gosh, I wish I'd been able to see more. You know, some people are show-averse. That, you know, they'll go every year, you know, folks who are in the restaurant business and stuff, you know, attendees and things. I love this show, and I've been coming since the 1980s. And as long as there have been restaurant and food shows, I've been attending them, you know, and in some cases all over the world. I've been to the, you know, international seafood trade shows in Brussels and in Shanghai, and The learning is huge. If you actually want to learn and you take the time to talk to people, and yes, there are some where you walk into a booth and someone is trying to sell you something, but if you actually ask for what you need, I mean, it's a good life lesson too, and say, you know, I'm not buying today, you know, but I'm fascinated by the technology behind your blank. Can you tell me about it? You learn incredible things. Yesterday, I spent the day in the booth with the spice company, Badia, that I have designed a line of my spices with. Mm-hmm. And so I was working with them yesterday, and I was in another building down in another corner. But I wandered around and a little bit in our little area, and two incredible things happened to me. I found the group Good Catch that is doing plant-based seafood. That was absolutely fascinating. Talked to them for a long time. And I do a lot of work advocating for a sustainable ocean management and producing a documentary series with David E. Kelly called Hope is in the Water, about how we manage our oceans and our fisheries. And so I'm fascinated by the role that plant-based seafood plays in it. And then later on tonight, I'm going to be participating in a panel about women in the industry and the ways in which we've underserved women since the dawn of time, but especially in the food service and restaurant and hospitality industry. And it's a national empowerment conference that is going on in a whole series of cities. And I participated in their debut online with a podcast and IG Live. And I was asked to attend the Chicago conference, which is tonight at Vermilion Restaurant. And I bumped into a fantastic pair of women who were the owners of a very small restaurant company that has one brick-and-mortar restaurant, two food trucks, and is opening a second brick-and-mortar restaurant, all very small. But they do shrimp po' boys and famous for their remoulade and all that other kind of stuff. And they're ex-teachers who quit and got into the business that they love. And I was talking to them about, you know, not only how underserved women are, but they were women of color. And they, you know, and I didn't have to tell them, but we were all, you know, noting that, you know, within the category of, you know, women are underserved, but within that group, women of color are especially underserved. And she told me something fascinating that I cannot shake out of my head. And it is, it's devastating the way people practice contempt prior to investigation of some type. She said not a day goes by that, because she works the truck or works the restaurant, that someone, and she's, this woman is not only personality plus, but is, you can just tell she's a fantastic leader, right? I mean, you just want to run through a brick wall for her when you hear her talking about anything. And she's very, very motivational. And she said not a day goes by that someone doesn't come up to her and say, hey, you tell your boss you're fantastic. You tell the owner you're amazing. Like, you're so cool. I come to this truck because the food's great, but also to say hi, you're just, you make my day. You got to tell your boss that. And, you know, she stopped telling people I'm the boss a while ago. And I get why. I get why. You know, she's trying to run a business. Then she's going to have this argument. By the way, she's in Mississippi and Memphis, right? So, you know, she's talking to guys. And by the way, she made a point of telling me, she says, it's not just old white guys, you know, it's all guys, right? Mm-hmm. That there is this, that the gender equity problems that we have in this country, mm-hmm. the race equity problems that we have in this country, the combination, the subtle forms in which racism plays a role in that has just stuck with me. And then today, of course, I'm here in a whole other building. This convention's massive, right?
It is. I mean, it's easy to get lost.
We were wheeling over here, and I saw one of the robotics displays. And I'm fascinated by the role that robotics plays in this industry, because there are so many jobs that are going to be replaced by automation in the next 10 years. And how do we account for that? Now, as we've seen an exodus from the industry, mostly on the service end of the equation, and the robotics are going to first enter on the production side of the business, where that balance is going to come in. I'm fascinated how this is going to play out, and I hope that it's people positive, you know, that we don't have a negative impact on human beings in the job market, but I'm not sure how it's not going to be that way. And then I'm spending the day here with another partner of ours, which is Tyndall, which is NextGen's plant-based chicken product, which I'm absolutely in love with. I think it's remarkable. I've tasted probably 30 or 40 different plant-based chicken products, and five or six companies had sort of made a run at, you know, knowing that I do a lot of work on the sustainability issues and a lot of other sort of bigger topics, and hoping that I would participate with them in helping to support their product. And I frankly wasn't interested because the product wasn't that great. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm like, if I'm, I believe in the cause, but if I'm going to stand next to a product associated with that cause, because I believe in plant-based foods as one of a dozen solutions to our sustainability. Mm-hmm. It's not the solution, right? but I believe it's a very, very important piece of a multi-solution program that is the only way that we're going to solve our climate crisis, solve our hunger issues, survive the wild cost swings that food is going through, the labor. I mean, so many different problems that we have. We have to use an army of solutions to combat those problems. Mm-hmm. And I think people who believe that there's just, you know, one answer to every problem are deluding themselves. But if I'm going to stand up next to something, it has to be delicious and it has to work for me. And I got a call from the CEO of the company, and he said, "Oh, I'll send you some product." I was like, "Great." So it arrived and we tested it, and I literally walked into the other room and I picked up the phone and I called Andre and I said, "Let's do something together." And he said, "Wow, mm-hmm. that was fast." I said, "I just tasted the product." He's like, "What'd you think?" You know, a lot of people have been able to figure out the flavor components. What Tyndall has been able to do is figure out the texture.
That's
issue.
The problem. That's the problem and, I've been having with a lot of like
yeah,
the
and so many.
Products.
Well, I would encourage you to try it.
Yeah.
So many, and see what you think. So many people forget that we use all of our senses, and touch is the texture piece, right? And we're touching it with our hands, breaking pieces apart. We're touching it with our mouths as we manipulate it. You know, and there's taste and smell and how it looks, right? And even the sound of it cooking is something that's very, very important. Mm-hmm. There are products that I've had where, you know, you're just baking a crappy little nugget that doesn't taste like chicken or have the texture of chicken, but there's no auditory pleasure taken from it. With Tyndall, it's manipulatable. You can take their thighs and simply bread them and fry them, and they sizzle beautifully, and so you have that mm-hmm. that pleasure of cooking with it, right? Mm-hmm. But you can also do a lot more with it. You know, you can roll it out with a pastry roller and create a stuffed Tyndall, you know, as if you were doing a rollatini of chicken or something like that, or a paillard on the grill. You can cut it in small pieces and you know, wok toss it. And there's so many different things that you can do with it. It's amazing. And at the end of today, hopefully I'm going to get a chance because Tyndall is in a different room than, what do they call these massive pavilions?
There's, the north, south.
Yeah, whatever. This McCormick is just too huge for me. It's a city. I'm now in a whole section of the show, so I'm excited to be able to see the stuff that's around. I'll be in the Tyndall booth today, and then I'm going to do a demo. I'm, you know, grateful to the conference for allowing me to get up and cook something, and I'm actually going to be making noodles with Tyndall.
Oh, interesting.
Which has become sort of my favorite way to eat them now that the weather has turned a lot warmer. I love cold Asian noodle bowls. And
but made out of chicken.
Well, I'm actually using, right. instead of noodles, I'm using the Tyndall.
That's so interesting.
And the flavor of, I mean, for people who are Japanese food freaks, and I'm one of them, is a very simple, famous warm weather dish, zaru soba, where buckwheat noodles are dipped or placed in a bowl of a sauce that's made with dashi and a little something to sweeten, either mirin or sugar, some soy sauce and other soy-based products in an icy, icy sauce, and then just a little nori and scallion on top. And it's one of my favorite noodle dishes in the whole world. And I was testing a recipe for it for a book that I'm writing. And as I was, you know, sort of fiddling around with it, I was like, I turned to our culinary director and I said, grab a couple of the Tyndall thighs out of the freezer. And you just let them sort of rest for a couple minutes at room temperature. You can slice them very thin with a knife, blanch them, chill them, and then use them in place of the noodles with this sauce. I said, let's see how that is. And it's off the charts.
That's crazy.
The product is so versatile that it allows I think, for a lot of creativity from the chef side of the equation. And I think that'll only get more powerful, not just for Tyndall, but for a whole new wave of products that mm-hmm. are going to be coming at us for the next, you know, for the foreseeable future, which I think is where the real fascinating component of this show is. I love going over to Cardinal or Libby Glass and seeing 8,000 new types of glassware and seeing one that I think would be cool at a restaurant that I want to open or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it's the innovation and the tech that has come into this show over the last 10 years, little by little by little by little, that now is on massive display, whether it's on the product line with something like Tyndall, or whether it's on the, you know, with robotics or with a different type of stove, right, that is run all on induction, that's cheaper, easier to install, that can allow for front-facing production in front of the customer mm-hmm. in a quick serve operation, right? Where someone can actually cook something in front of somebody, but you don't have to have a hood, you don't have to have anything that's intruding between that chef consumer experience. I think these things are really fascinating, and I think that as this dribbles down to the consumer over the next couple of years in so many different ways, it's going to change the way that we think about food and interact with food.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the industry is changing so incredibly fast. And I'm curious what you, because you mentioned all the plant-based meats, so I'm curious if you've thought about the cell-based meats and what you think about those.
I think it's a very, very important area of investigation for everybody. Cell-based replication of food is going to happen. I just think that the products that are coming out of that space, and I've been lucky enough to try a lot of them, even ones that are in development, and was one of the first people to taste it many, many years ago over in Europe. It's just not there yet in terms of the wholesomeness of the product from a dining perspective. The product itself is a wholesome product. I don't want anyone to misunderstand me. There's nothing untoward about it or you know, it's simple cell replication. It just doesn't have the texture and flavor that rings my bell.
Yeah, for sure.
But they will get it because the science is...
It's in development.
You know, when you look at the trillions with a T of dollars that are a part of the commercial, let's just say beef, mm-hmm. commercial beef industry on all sides of the ecosystem of beef, right? From the dollars invested in how it's raised, the land abuse, the water abuse, right? All the way down to the consumer and the dollars of producing it, right? I mean, when you look at all the hamburgers and steaks and everywhere that beef is around the world, I mean, this is you know, a massive, massive financial ecosystem. So when disruptors come into that, there's so much money to be made mm-hmm. that when, you know, the land rush to get it right is just staggering, right? Because everyone wants to get it right because they know that there's so much at stake.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why capitalism, as much of a left-wing Lindsay liberal as I am, mm-hmm. I believe that capitalism and big business is a way that we solve problems, right? So I think that, you know, scientific innovators are going to figure out how to produce this. It's going to allow us to fight our climate crisis. It's going to, you know, big business is going to step in. Big food, I'm not as anti-big food as other people. Big food can be very helpful. They have the dollars, the distribution, they're global. You know, there's so many ways in which they can help us solve problems faster because they have reach and human beings and capabilities that other smaller companies don't have. And so I think when those innovators and disruptors are able to partner with certain big food companies that want to help make a change, it's going to be very, very powerful and allow us to quickly solve some problems, I'm hoping.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that your work in sustainability is unparalleled. I feel like you've done so much for it. What are you most excited for in, like, 5 years from now on things in the restaurant industry that's going to help our planet?
I think the movement away from eating conventional, you know, animals of all types. I'm a carnivore. I have, today I don't have a plan to become a vegetarian or a vegan. I have reduced my meat intake by probably 75% over the course of the last couple of years. Now, if a lot of people started doing that, our some of our food problems would solve themselves almost instantaneously. I always use the comparable, you know, everyone understands the idea now because we've been talking about it since the 70s, that we need to reduce our reliance on foreign oil, right? Everyone gets it. And everyone gets the idea that if we put laws in this country that the minimum miles per gallon went from, I think it's 17 now, up to 20 or 21, that would instantly reduce our reliance on foreign oil, that 4 miles per gallon, right? By percentage. And it's, you know, it's very simple math. If we could shrink the amount of, you know, beef, chicken, lamb, you know, fish, etc., that we ate, and started to use eat plants, right? I mean, you don't need to eat plant-based blank. You can just eat more plants. If you found products that you're like, oh my god, I'm just jonesing, you know, for a fried chicken sandwich. Okay, great. So take some Tyndall out of your freezer and fry it up. You literally get the same satiety on all levels. I mean, you know, I've started doing that, right? If you start to investigate what you can do with soy products and tofu, I mean, right? I mean, you just keep going down the line. If we reduce the simple volume of meat, you know, I'm 60. I remember as a young man, every meal was 14 ounces of animal protein, right? Half chicken, giant pork chop, a big steak, right? A huge knob of broccoli and an oversized baked potato, and you help yourself to the fixins bar. I mean, that was what continental restaurants were all about, right? Yep. Human beings, we love, I mean, I happen to be, I travel a lot to the eastern part of the world, the Far East in particular. And when people go out to eat and they go to Thai restaurants, Japanese restaurants, Chinese restaurants, Vietnamese restaurants, they always come back and they say, oh my God, I had the most incredible meal and blah, 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 blah. Now, I know how those restaurants operate, and there's a lot of vegetable, a lot of rice noodle, a lot of other product with a small amount of meat, mm-hmm. right? It's not 14 ounces in every portion. Some restaurants have increased the volume of animal protein to account for the American taste. But if we can actually be learning from these other cultures and adapting to the way in which they're eating. I just put a picture up on my Instagram, which is at Chef AZ, if people don't follow me.
I'm sure
I'm
following.
Well, no, I'm sure not. But it is a good follow. I put a Vietnamese beef salad up, and the picture was not taken at our studio kitchen. I took it in my home because I'll cook a tri-tip sirloin, and it'll work for three or four meals instead of one meal, right? And at one point, just slice it thin, cut it into ribbons, and just with lots of vegetables and a wonderful fish sauce and lime vinaigrette that's based off of Vietnamese nguoc cham and a little bit of toasted rice powder, so you have that authentic smoky aroma that toasted rice powder gives you. And toasted rice powder, by the way, for those that are wondering, the missing ingredient in their Vietnamese food is just rice. Put it in a pan, toast it in the oven until it's brown, and just either pulse it in your food product. I grind mine in a mortar and pestle because it's a better product. And then you sprinkle it and use it in all those foods. That's that nutty, sort of powdery thing that most people don't know what it is in all of their Vietnamese and Thai food, where they're like, what is that? But you end up using about 2-3 ounces of beef per person, right?
It's a big
per
difference.
Portion versus, right, it's huge. And so when it comes to change over the next 4 or 5 years, I think that's where we're headed. I see it as inevitable because I've seen the tsunami of PR and marketing, and most importantly, of proper education on the issues for people. These CAFO farms that are leaking, you know, horrific chemicals into our water table that then go downriver, you know, into, just pick any river in the south, right, and winds up being an algae bloom in some corner of a Gulf community, is not driven by some natural anomaly in that biosphere. It's driven by chemicals that are coming into the water, right? And I think that, you know, we're destroying so much of our planet so quickly that people are actually seeing it in their own backyards. It used to be in someone else's backyard. Americans are very selfish culturally. If we don't see it affecting us, we're not really that involved, right? One of the saddest things that I heard the other night at an event was someone talking about how weary they were of all the Ukraine news. Now, this war
has been... What a luxury.
Right. I mean, this war has only been going on, you know, I mean, almost 3 months, something like that. Maybe it's 11, 12 weeks at this point. It's a horrific conflict with, you know, 10 million refugees and a country of 43 million people that madman is trying to erase off the face of the globe. And people are tired of hearing about it. I think we haven't heard enough about it. You know, but now when it, on the food side, you know, the comparable story is, you know, in Appalachia, Apalachicola, Florida, was the largest oyster bed in North America. Mm-hmm. And it was the largest oyster bed commercially farmed in the world 80 years ago, and was still a massive producer. I mean, oysters got more and more popular, so they started coming from everywhere, you know. Mm-hmm. But Apalachicola oysters were, you know, the pride of the Gulf. And Apalachicola, Florida, you know, had 100 oyster companies lining the roads, and it was a tourist destination. And now it's the town is no longer any of that. There are no more oysters being harvested on the Apalachicola oyster beds. They simply don't exist anymore. The salinity in the water increased enough. By a very, very low percentage, but just enough to allow for certain predators to come in, these little tiny shell drillers and certain fish that could come in and eat the oyster when they were very small. And so there's now no more oysters. I'm not talking about some. There are no more oysters coming out of Apalachicola Bay, except for some people that are experimenting in protected areas with certain types of aquaculture. Now, the loss of thousands of jobs, loss of tourism. You know, we did this story in What's Eating America, my MSNBC series. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of struck by the number of people there who blamed it on people overwatering their lawns north of them, and therefore there wasn't enough fresh water coming downstream in the river. All the scientists there, I mean, there's no one who doesn't know the problem is actually the most simple of all. Rain has actually moved. Annual rainfall there has decreased by like tenfold over the last 20 years, and it's all moved north. Now, I live in Minnesota, which is north, and that's where that rainfall has moved. Mm-hmm. And now it rains too heavy and too hard, so we can't get our plants in the ground the way that we used to. And then instead of gentle soaking rains in the spring and at the end of the year that helped our growing seasons, we have these heavy, heavy rains that are destroying apple crops, that are preventing farmers. Instead of a nice, gentle soaking rain, it's flooding and creating mud. So you can imagine what happens with seedlings that have been put into the ground. So it's a very simple thing. We have an environmental crisis that is not going away. It's permanent.
And people aren't paying enough attention to it.
Well, they're slowly starting to. I mean, this is my point about the food issue. Because it's happening in their own backyards, I talked to, oystermen and local folks in Apalachicola who did not believe in this, that this was a problem, that it was something else causing it, who now understand we have a climate crisis, right? They weren't buying the science. Now they are. I spoke to farmers in rural Minnesota who were blaming it on everything and then finally realized, oh my gosh, they look at their logbooks. Farmers keep incredible logbooks, so do fishermen. So do, I mean, you know, some of them have logbooks going back generations, handwritten by other family members. They're now seeing that it is a problem in their own backyards. And I think that, more than anything else, is going to spur people into action. And I'm hoping that over the course of the rest of my lifetime, we see the American diet change into something that looks more like the Asian diet. A lot more vegetables, a lot more movement, a greater variety of plants, a greater variety of fermented foods that are better for gut health and for brain activity, less of a reliance on big fillet fish and on more of a reliance on smaller head-on fish, less of a reliance on beef and, you know, cattle and hoofed animals. I hope we see a return to naturally raised poultry. And can eliminate these horrific companies that are, you know, using, you know, cages and technology not for good, and raising chickens that are unhealthy for us and unhealthy for the animals. I think in everything there should be balance, and I'm bullish on that. I still have some optimism about human beings doing the right thing, and I think the capitalism, I think there's money to be made in doing the right thing as long as we're educating people along the way. And I think that's the part that people undersell, you know, and that's where I know with you, I'm preaching the converted. You're in the business of educating, right? You know, you're a journalist. And so it's, you know, people need to understand more and more of what's really happening and not their version of what's happening. And if we can start to trust other people that what they're saying is true, we've lost the trust in our neighbors. This divisiveness that is corrupted this country is also about a lack of trust, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I can pick up, you know, a magazine and trust that what I'm reading there from a journalist is objective, mm-hmm. and I hope that restores that curiosity in the human spirit that will help move us into that area of wellness and fixing the problems that we have.
Yeah, that's a great note to end on. Thank you so much.